Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. You know that saying, you gotta have money to make money? If you want to start a business, getting access to capital can be a big challenge. For Black business owners and founders, they can face even more barriers accessing funding. Liz Birkandave is on a mission to level the playing field through BKR Capital. It is a venture capital fund that invests in Black-led companies. She'll be here to tell us about it. And many people go to the casino and take part in sports betting for fun and to test their luck, and all is fine. But some people go a little too far. How do you know if it has become a problem for you, and what to do if it is affecting you financially? Mike Bergeron is a certified nonprofit credit counselor at Credit Canada. He'll talk about some of the warning signs and the steps you can take to get yourself out of gambling debt. Plus, know what you are retiring to. That's the advice from certified financial planner Mark McGrath. He shared a very, very personal Twitter post about his dad. It's a compelling story. It is a heartbreaking story about the emotional and psychological impact of retirement. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. I was doing that thing when you scroll mindlessly through Twitter, as you do, scrolling, and I came across this thread, quote, "Make sure you know what you're retiring to do." This was a hard post to write. I almost didn't write it, in fact. I've started and trashed this story many times, but I believe there are important lessons in this story we can learn from. Warning, this story does not have a happy ending. The post was by Mark McGrath, a certified financial planner at Wellington Altus Private Wealth, and it is a story about his dad. He's in Squamish, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce.
This is a hard thread to read. I can only imagine how hard a thread it was for you to write. I want to start first with who your dad was at the peak of his life.
Yeah, great question. So he was many things. Primarily, he was a good father, of course, and he went through a lot growing up. He was very disciplined. He was an excellent golfer. At one point, he was a scratch golfer. In fact, tried to get me into golf very early, and I rebelled hard. I still hate golf to this day, and I think it's because he forced me to play it. Right. But he was a businessman, and so he knew that golf may be important to me later on if I sort of followed in his footsteps. But he was a black belt in karate, and I think that's where a lot of his discipline came from. He used to do push-ups on his index fingers, even into his 50s, just to kind of remind us, I think, of who the boss was in our household. And he was a businessman. He ran a tile store, and he had done that for decades, and he did it very well. He was quite successful. I don't know that he loved tile, but he liked being that person. He liked being a businessman.
Was he an extrovert? Did he love the people side of it?
I think he did. Yeah, he was very social. He liked the business side of it. It was a small tile store, so there was only a handful of employees. So he'd go to the shop on most days. It was him and one or two other guys that were his employees. But I think he liked, the waves of traffic, the people coming through and talking to people. He was quite social outside of his business as well. So he was close friends with the guys that he worked with and obviously many others. So he spent time on the weekends out and about and, just socializing.
And then what changed?
So retirement is the singular event that I can think of that really led to this. He worked hard. He didn't work, 60, 80 hours a week or anything like that. He was still disciplined with his schedule, but he worked towards retirement as maybe a singular goal. So he saw his business as a means to an end. As I mentioned, I don't think tile was, a passion of his, but developing something that he could turn into a financial asset that would allow him the financial flexibility to retire. I think that was really, really his focus. And when he was 58 years old, he sold his business. And my family and I, my brother, my mom, I don't think we knew that he was even in the market to sell his business. Like, he was very private and he didn't really talk about his finances or anything like that with us. And just one day we were out for dinner at, just some pub, nothing fancy. And we were, I think I was eating hot wings, having a beer with him. And he said, well, I sold the business. And we kind of just, we were taken aback, right? It was just, you know, lightning strike. Like, what do you mean you sold the tile shop? Wow. And he's like, yeah, I stress tested it, you know, 8 ways from Sunday and I can't fail. I've got the capital. I'm done. I'm exiting the business. And so we were thrilled. We were excited for him. That's really what he'd worked so hard to achieve. And, you know, within a few, well, actually, no, he booked a trip to Asia. He was a huge fan of the Asian people. He used to read books about, you know, the Okinawans in Japan and their longevity and the number of centenarians that came from there. And so he booked a trip. He'd been there many times, but he booked a big long trip as a celebration, a reward to himself for retirement. And he came back a couple of months later. And within a few weeks of that, I believe he was back working for the guys that he sold his business to. And of course, this was not a financial decision. It was a social one. He just wanted to be back with his buddies at the shop, I think. And he was just doing it a couple of days a week. And it just didn't, I think his sense of belonging or sense of purpose at the shop had changed. He wasn't the boss anymore. It wasn't his shop anymore. And so he didn't do that for too long.
What did you notice first about a change in his mental health?
Yeah, it's tough to put a finger on exactly what it was. It was relatively slow. And to be honest, I think maybe some of the warning signs didn't jump out to us at first. It was a kind of a culmination of smaller behavioral changes and changes in his attitude that kind of let us understand, hey, something here is going on. And for a little bit more of the backstory, he was very social. Years prior to this, my mom and him had split up. They remained very, very close, great friends, lived very close to each other. But my brother and I at the time were living more at my mom's house than my dad's. I was out, but my brother was living at home. And so when we got together, we would go to my mom's house. So I wasn't seeing him as much at that time. I was, you know, recently married as well. And so I didn't see him as much, but my brother and my mom saw him more frequently. So they may have picked up on something that I hadn't picked up on. But he started to... just his general demeanor had changed. He was a joker. He loved to make jokes and laugh, and he was just doing less of that. And over time, a few things changed. At one point he stopped eating steak, which maybe for some people seems like a normal dietary change. That was not the case for him. He'd been eating steak multiple times a week for his entire life. Like he would make hamburgers at home, and he would be eating the raw ground beef while he was making hamburgers. Like that's how much of a meat fanatic he was. And one day he was like, I don't like steak anymore. And so this was either a chemical or biological or physical change that I think took place, and maybe it was, you know, a psychological one as well. But that to me was, you know, something is up, right?
And then I'm obviously fast forwarding here in time. Then you got a phone call from an unknown number.
Yeah. So this was a Thursday night in October, and I had gone to sleep. It was around 11:30 at night. I got a private phone call, and I didn't answer it because I typically do not answer private phone calls. And they called back right away. And when I picked up the phone, they said, it's the police, it's the RCMP. You need to go and see your mom. She's very upset. And this was a strange conversation. Because, you know, what do you mean my mom's upset? And at the time I was living in East Vancouver. My mom's in Richmond. So for your listeners who don't know those locations, it's about a 45 minute drive. And so I said, look, my mom's upset. I get that. I'll give her a call. And he's like, no, you got to get over there. And so I asked the officer, if I'm driving across, you know, town in the middle of night, I want to know what I'm doing it for. And he kind of took a breath and paused and said, your father's dead.
Unimaginable.
Yeah.
So you have had some time. This is 10 years ago that this happened. Is that right?
10 years this year, yeah, this October. Yeah.
What do you think happened?
I think his sense of purpose and his identity was wrapped up in his business and he didn't know it. I think his goal of retiring was so important to him that I don't think he weighed enough how important that business was to him. And without it, I don't think he had enough on the other side of retirement to keep him going. I don't think he had that sense of purpose and identity that the business brought him. And I think that maybe loneliness, and I don't think it was boredom because he was very active, But I think he stripped himself of that identity by letting go of that business so abruptly.
As you say, this is the first time that you shared this story so publicly, but given what you do for a living, I can imagine that it has been in the background, perhaps every day for the last 10 years, as you work with your clients who are doing their retirement savings and they're doing all the right things to How would you say your personal experience has informed the work that you do with your clients?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we don't, as financial planners, we, you know, the curriculum that we follow traditionally doesn't have training in this, right? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of financial training, but we don't really have training in the psychological and emotional aspects of retirement. And so, I mean, you're right. It's been in the back of my mind. It's something I'm acutely aware of, but at the same time, it's been challenging to go out and figure out how to include these types of things in conversations with clients, right? And, you know, in reality, some clients that you work with for a long time, they become close, they become friends. And so these conversations happen more casually, but with somebody you don't know very well, it's a very difficult topic to broach. And in that Twitter thread that I wrote, there's another young advisor, and he actually sought specific training in palliative care and bereavement because he works with so many retirees. And he actually said it was one of the best things that he ever did. So I think, you know, even myself and other advisors need to seek out additional training to have these conversations with clients.
What kind of response did you get from that Twitter thread?
It was overwhelming. I had absolutely no idea the impact of this, that it would have on people. You know, when I posted that story, I thought it was an interesting story. I thought people would enjoy the story and the lesson that can be learned from it, but I had no idea the reach it was going to have. And I got literally hundreds of messages in my inbox on Twitter of people who had gone through something similar. And it didn't always end the same way. Sometimes it did, but there were people who, for example, were pushing their parents to retire from their business, and they'd be pushing hard. And they wrote to me saying, you know, now I understand why they don't want to retire, and I'm going to lay off. I'm going to stop pushing them so hard because now I can see what you're talking about in my own family, my own parents. So the response was overwhelming. Just people, it seemed to really help people, and I didn't know that it would. And, you know, that feels good. But at the same time, it's also tragic that so many people out there are going through it.
What lessons do you hope people take away from this story? And I will say, I just so admire your willingness to put it out there to the world, because I really do think it is a story that can make such a big difference, both for the kids, right, how we engage with our parents, but also for those who are at that point in life when they're considering the next chapter. What do you hope people take away?
I think it's something you need to look at earlier than you think. You know, even myself, for example, as a financial planner, I love what I do. I absolutely love it. I can't even consider doing anything else. And I can start to see in my own behaviors and my own work how this could easily happen to me just in terms of my identity. You know, I'm the money guy. Like, people come to me for money questions, and I love it. It's hugely rewarding. But I'm 39. And so for me, retirement is, you know, hopefully decades away. But even now, especially after writing it, I think taking a good hard look at your life, not just through the lens of your career, but also through the lens of your social capacity, you know, whether it's religion or it's volunteering, that sort of social capital that you have, and what structures do you have outside of work that are really going to bring you purpose? So I think taking stock of where you are right now, regardless of where you are in your career, is a hugely important thing. And as you ramp up into retirement, seek help in this area. There are programs out there that deal with this. There are training programs that even employers can get themselves involved in to help their employees make these types of transitions. And, you know, I don't know, a lot of people can't do this, but can you step away and do a sabbatical before retirement? Can you really test this out to find out for yourself if this is something that might affect you? I think those are important steps.
Parents, for us as parents and for kids who have parents or had parents, we know that they leave an extraordinary imprint on us. What is something that you are grateful to your dad for?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I am who I am today because of my parents, right? They were great parents. I was a bit troublesome at times when I was a teenager, and they, you know, they put up with me. you know, they raised us well. They loved us unconditionally. They were, you know, they came to every sports game we ever had. They encouraged us. You know, my mom's still around and I talk to her frequently. You know, I think they just, they did everything that they could to ensure that we were set up for success. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. It's hard to say one thing, right? Because again, it's a culmination of everything they did to raise us. But, you know, that story stays with me. And I look back and remember fondly the times that I spent with him and some of the lessons that he taught me growing up that I still carry with me today.
Mark, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Likewise.
Mark McGrath is a certified financial planner at Wellington Altus Private Wealth. He joined us to talk about his dad and so many lessons, such bravery in the telling, and a real, I think, call to action for all of us as we look ahead to see what we want to be doing in that next chapter and what we need to do it in a healthy and sustainable way. Coming up next on Moolala, Mike Bergeron, certified nonprofit credit counselor at Credit Canada. He'll be here to talk about gambling debt and what to do about it. And later, a venture capital fund helping to make funding more accessible for Black-led companies. It's called BKR Capital.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. We're seeing more and more and more of these advertisements for sports betting these days. They're everywhere. They're like on billboards, they're online, they're everywhere. And this is on top of the fact that Canadians have been able to gamble in lots of different ways for a very, very long period of time. Right. For a lot of people, betting on sports, going to the casino, going onto their phone to do a little gambling, no big deal. Fun, exciting, great. But how much gambling is too much gambling? And how do you know if you've actually developed an addiction that is really costing you financially? Mike Bergeron is a certified nonprofit credit counselor at Credit Canada. And this is a kind of call he receives a lot. So we're going to talk to him about gambling and debt in particular. He's in Windsor, Ontario today. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the kinds of calls that you receive for people who are starting to wake up to the fact that their gambling has become a problem for them.
Right. So on the news, I'm finding the traditional call is when things got really out of hand. It's almost to the point where they're late on rent, arrears on their bills, very stressed, high level stress, nowhere to turn. Sometimes, the debt is unknown to loved ones, family, and they have no one to really turn to. So it is very, it's a very challenging conversation to support them through it. But on the other side, there is those random calls that people are really proactive and they see that they haven't accumulated much debt, but they see they're dwindling their savings plans and they want to get it resolved and get the support before it gets to that point. So it's not a, it's a small percentage, but it's nice to see that some people are being aware and being proactive to their challenge.
You've been working as a credit counselor for a long period of time. And back in the olden days, people had to like hoof it to a casino in order to gamble and in some cases to get themselves into trouble. Now there are many more ways in which they can find themselves in that. Is there a, I'm using air quotes here, a stereotypical person who finds themselves in this situation, or does it really cross age, income, you know, background, all that?
Yeah, I think I've been noticing a lot through the board, male, female, everything in between. I remember just not that many years ago, me and my brother and my dad, we would go to the local corner store and we would bet on the local the Sunday football games, and it was amusing to have a little bit involved in the game. But today, like you're saying, with all the advertisements, I don't remember the last time I watched a sporting event where during the commercial breaks they weren't promoting these online betting sites. You can bet right at home on your local device, which could automatically cause some severe financial burdens if you don't set some really good perimeters. So it's a lot more aggressive, I'm noticing, in that sports betting field versus, like you were saying, Bruce, having to go to the casino to place that bet on that winning team. It's a lot easier now. So I can see a lot more people, younger people, unfortunately, getting into this addiction a little bit sooner than most.
With any behavior, there is a level of moderation in which it's like, not a big deal. You can have a glass of wine. That's very different than a couple of bottles of wine. How does someone who gambles know when it's too much?
Yeah, I think the majority of times when I'm speaking and doing my presentations or speaking to someone on the phone, I really try to get a good understanding to that question as well. And the majority of the time, it's when they don't know when to stop, they don't know when to leave, or they never really thought of safe gambling habits, like setting limitations on, you know what, after $50, we'll leave, something along those lines. So I find sometimes it's a little bit of that. Sometimes you can tell by the isolation, depression, the remorse they feel about what they got themselves into. Sometimes it could be just the fact of lying about how much they've lost. That's a traditional or a very common thing I'm hearing too. So those are probably the key ones that I'm hearing most often.
So the light bulb goes off, an individual realizes, okay, this is actually something that I have to get a handle on. Where do they start? How do they start to deal with, and I'm going to make the case that there is debt here. There isn't always. Some people can fund their gambling and it's not a situation where they have debt, but let's take the case that they do. Mm-hmm. How do you start to deal with gambling debt?
So I think the first thing is that acknowledgement that I have a problem. I've spoken to many people over my counseling career that seeked support regarding the debt, like you mentioned, Bruce, and they never really dealt with the addiction. Therefore, acknowledging the addiction and seeking support about that is always step one. Regarding how to do that, believe it or not, I think our local PlaySmart or the provincial associations that oversee responsible gambling have done a lot of good initiatives to support. Obviously, Canadian Mental Health Association in your local province is a good stepping point to get maybe some self-exclusion contacts of how to go about doing that, or what kind of counseling is available, or support groups are available to support you with that type of situation.
Your job really lives in two worlds. You are head oriented, you've got the math, you're looking at the numbers, and you're heart oriented, because the human at the other end of the phone is suffering. They're dealing with really tough circumstances. You referenced that some people suffer alone. They don't tell a spouse or a family member. In fact, they may actively keep it a secret because of shame and guilt and all that stuff.
Right.
How do you recommend that people cross that threshold and have those tough conversations?
Yeah, I think there's a form of empathy that goes along with speaking to the individual who's going through that, understanding on a personal level, knowing loved ones that have gone through some very similar addictions, and how it impacts them, how it impacts the family around them, and give them the tools to let them know that they're not alone through this journey. That specifically the counseling element, I know a lot of resources throughout the country that can support them, but provide them the awareness that we will get through this together. We'll go through a personalized financial plan. We're going to go through income, expenses. We're going to go through assets. What is available to start working on getting those debts under control, and potentially even some options through insolvency or debt management through Credit Canada. Obviously, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're helping people get out of debt and back into life. So we want to make sure that it's an all-round picture. It's just not one element. We're doing a whole transformation of their financial lifestyles potentially.
Your conversation with clients is confidential. It's one-on-one, and there's some comfort in the fact that you're a stranger, because you're certainly not going to judge them. It's what you do professionally.
Right.
If they asked you, how do I talk to my spouse about this issue? Give me a sentence. How do I actually, what words fall out of my mouth in Right. order to begin that conversation? What would you say?
Yeah, I think most of the time it's back to that acknowledgement that I've made a mistake. And right now I don't need judgment. I need support. And I think most times when, regardless of what you're going through, we're afraid of the response. We're not afraid of the situation. We're kind of aware we got ourselves into this scenario, but we're afraid of how others will perceive looking at them, and will they judge them, or how are they going to react? We're afraid of that type of response. So I just kind of say to make sure that you're open, you acknowledge that you've made a mistake, and you're asking for a little bit of understanding that you're seeking support, not just financially, but also with the addiction. And I think that could go a long way. Specifically when it comes to loved ones, nobody wants to see people we care about struggle. We just need to take that step and have faith that they love you just as much as you love them.
One of the things people will say when they've had behavior that they know doesn't work for them is they'll say, well, I did it because I could. Are there ways to make it tougher for the individual to walk into that casino, to log onto their phone? What are some things that they could provide as circuit breakers for themselves to just lower the risk when the temptation hits, you know, their credit card isn't connected to the app or whatever?
Right. Yeah, that's one good one, is just putting yourself some perimeters on your utilization on credit. But like I mentioned a little bit earlier, Canadian Mental Health Association in your local province, they do have the stepping stones for self-exclusion. If you find you need yourself a break, maybe you just need a break because you're just not 100% sure if this is your situation getting carried away, or you just need some time to reflect and maybe get your situation back on track, you can put yourself on a 6-month probation where you can attend in the casino, or they'll also support you on the steps of stopping yourself, be able to go on any online platform, any kind of poker site or gaming site, betting site, so to speak. The other thing that people can do is put on limitations on these online sites. These are the ones that it can get carried away quite quickly, because you're sitting at home and you're drinking your coffee and it's like, oh my God, I lost $500 already. It can go really quickly. However, if you set yourself some perimeters, $50 in a 24-hour period, once that, you know, if you lost $50, it logs you out of the system and you can't get back in until the next day. So there are some perimeters online that I think the associations under the gambling sites have created to prevent. Obviously, it's not perfect. No system is perfect, but it prevents if you utilize it to the best of its capabilities.
Mike, appreciate your time today. Thank you.
No, Bruce. Thank you.
Mike Bergeron is a certified nonprofit credit counselor at Credit Canada, and he's someone who's got a tremendous amount of experience working with clients who are dealing with gambling debt. So Mike mentioned a whole bunch of resources out there. You can also pick up the phone and call one of our counselors. Maybe you'll even get Mike.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to Lise Birkendavi, managing partner and co-founder of BKR Capital, about how she's trying to level the playing field for Black-led companies when it comes to making funding more accessible. Stay up to date on all things Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It comes once a month. Nothing to sell ya, just updates on things that we have done on SiriusXM here, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, on BNN Bloomberg. Just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple,
with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks,
SiriusXM 167.
Talking about your money, it can be uncomfortable. It can be hard to get started. And when you're in a relationship with another human, the stakes are pretty high. So this next conversation is a particularly interesting one because it is a very actionable way to get the conversation started using conversation cards. Financial therapist Eric Wasserman has created a deck of these cards to get the conversation flowing in a fun way. She joins us from South Florida. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I have used these kinds of cards in many other areas. We have, you know, a box at the cottage for getting people talking around the campfire. Why did you decide to create these conversation cards for money?
Well, that was exactly it, Bruce. I was out with a friend. We were sitting at a bar and there was a couple next to us using some of these conversation cards.
Yeah.
And they leaned over and they said, hey, you guys want to use these? I was out with my friend and we started asking each other questions. And it was fun and it was engaging. And we both learned a little bit about ourselves and about each other at the same time. Questions we probably would never have even asked or talked about or come to mind. And that's when the idea went off is, wow, what if these cards were actually about money? You know, it's hard to go out on a date and start learning about somebody and be like, so what's your credit score? Right. You know, it just doesn't organically generally come in conversation. But if you're forced, quote unquote, to do it because you're sitting there playing a game and the question is there, all of a sudden you're talking about something that was not even on your radar.
Right.
And learning more.
And you don't have to infer from the asker that there's an ulterior motive. Like, why are you asking me that question? Well, the answer is because I pulled it out of the deck of cards. There's nothing like, don't be charged by that, right?
Right. Exactly. You know, right. I mean, and the questions are all over the place. Like, what were the financial roles for each person in your family growing up? Who paid the bills and who made the financial decisions?
What would you, and I'm going to ask you for a made up categorization here. What are the easiest questions in the deck? Like, you pull that one out and you go, phew, that's fine. That one's easy to answer. And then in a second, I'm going to ask you for the hardest. Well, what are the easiest ones?
Oof, the easier ones is, let me see, I'm taking a quick look here. Ah, what's the next vacation or holiday you want to take? And how much do you think it will cost? Mm,
great. Fully, that's about dreams and yeah, a little bit about budgeting. It's future oriented. It doesn't flag any of my major weaknesses as a human. Great. I can see how that those would be easier. Okay. What are some of the harder ones that, you know, if we were to be watching someone pull cards out of the deck and they pulled a particular card, you'd be like, oh yeah, oftentimes people struggle answering that one.
Have you declared bankruptcy before? And if so, what did you learn from it? But that might be a little harder to answer for some people if they do have to declare bankruptcy for whatever reason.
What advice would you have for people that would provide some context for this exercise? Because I can imagine for people who haven't been together for very long, friends or romantically, it would be different than people who are looking at these cards having already invested 10, 20 years in that relationship.
You know, even people who've been together 10 or 20 years still need to have these conversations because a lot of times they've skipped over them also. So by having these conversations, it creates more dynamic. And it's not just asking the questions, but it's understanding the why behind them. And I'll give you a good example of a question is, what if somebody asked you to borrow $1,000? Is it expected to pay back or is it a gift? These are things, if you're newly in a relationship or been together for years, is something you probably want to talk about. Oftentimes we see people hiding in relationships that they gave money to their brother or to their sister or to their mother because they're ashamed or their partner is angry at them. But there's a why behind it that they're doing it. And understanding that why also will help understand your partner better and their financial decision making.
Whether these questions are asked on conversation cards or in a private session with you as a financial therapist, they can be often the beginning of something, sometimes something great, and sometimes something really, really hard. Like it opens up a wound, perhaps, of one individual's past or something that is unfolded in the relationship that's been particularly painful. What advice would you have for people who are engaging in these tough questions about what comes next?
Great question. And that's true, is once you start uncovering things, it might make you uncomfortable. This is a topic you haven't really discussed or worked on. You know, we're sent out in the world with learning geometry, but we're not sent out in the world understanding our budgets. So what I would suggest is sit with it, be real with it. You can't put an action plan together or make improvements if you don't know your real truth. And your truth might be, I'm in debt or I have a poor relationship with money. The second part of that conversation is, these are the three things I'm working on, and list those three things out.
Are there questions or answers that you have seen be an insurmountable issue for couples?
You know, I don't. And everybody who comes to me, I'm like, you're not the worst I've seen.
Do you just say that? Or is it that you've got like one couple from 7 years ago who were so horrendous and you're grateful that you worked with them because they set a new low bar?
You know, I've seen some really wild things.
Erica, tell our listeners where they can get their own edition, their own package of your financial conversation cards.
Excellent. The best place to get it is over on my website at yourfinancialtherapist.com. There's a link there to buy it direct from me or through Amazon.
Oh, great. And they're what, $24, $25 US, something like that?
You got it.
Awesome. Erica, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Always have fun talking to you, Bruce.
It's great to talk to you. Eric Wasserman is a financial therapist, and we were talking about these conversation cards that she's come up with. There's 50 in a deck. Some of them are super simple questions and some are really, really hard. But I promise you, if you go through the whole deck, you will have a new foundation for your relationship with your partner and with your own money. If you have a question about money, a thought, a story idea, a comment, whatever, easy to get a hold of us. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The playing field just is not level for everyone when it comes to accessing venture capital investment. Liz Birkandavi wanted to help address this issue by making it more level, a little bit more level, in particular for Black founders to get funding. She is the managing partner and co-founder of BKR Capital, a venture capital fund that invests invests in Black-led companies. She was also named a 2023 Changemaker by Report on Business magazine. Hello there, Liz.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Why did you decide to start BKR Capital? What is the problem you are trying to solve?
Well, for me, there was a real disconnect between the perception that exists, you know, with respect to the Black community and the talent and brilliance I would see around me. And that's really all around the world. I grew up, you know, around incredibly talented people. And for me, it was more than just service to the Black community. It was also service to our community as a whole. If you have a portion of entrepreneurs who have the talent to create amazing innovation that would serve everyone, but are overlooked because we don't see enough example of success with that face, right? There's always a bit of bias in investment and you're trying to do pattern matching, then we're all losing from that, to be honest. So we saw, myself and Isaac Olowolafe saw in this a great opportunity from an investment perspective, but also a great opportunity for sustainable change, because when you use forces of private market to uplift the population, you know that this will be something that doesn't stop there, right?
How far back in the gestation of an idea, in the creation of a founder, does the, I'm going to use air quotes here, the problem go? And I ask because if you've got people in the room who are ready, set to go with these genius ideas, that's one thing. They're ready to go. But when we think about the systemic barriers for BIPOC Canadians, they really can go back multiple generations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's definitely, other types of support that needs to be brought for the overall population. But something that we have to understand is that there is a lot of diversity within the Black population itself, right? So you have communities that have been oppressed for a longer time and that do need to see role models that look like them to understand how they can thrive and, you know, understand the possibilities that is in front of them. But then you have other communities that have had those examples of success. I would say maybe the more recent immigrations, whether it's from the Caribbean or it's from the African continent, and, you know, generations of entrepreneurs who want to also keep on building and have this capability. So there's different problems depending on the background of the entrepreneurs you're speaking with. So by investing in those gems that we find, we basically solve a lot of these issues, because then we shine lights on role models from the Black communities. And then you create this understanding from others that, okay, yes, we can do that. And here are the tools that exist that support us in doing that as well.
The phrase venture capital fund sounds ruthless. It sounds really like focused on the numbers and you are hoping to discover the next Facebook or whatever. How do you toggle between your deeply felt commitment to make a difference for this community in particular with a return on investment that the air quotes typical VC fund would be perhaps exclusively about?
Now, for me, it's one and the same, right? So basically, we're looking at founders that are talented and promising from the Black community. So we're looking at the opportunities with the same lens. The goal is to generate outsized financial return in a place where nobody else is looking at, right? So that's the same thing for every venture capital firm. Let's say you have a firm that's focused on fintech. What they will say is that I have this ability to find the best companies in the fintech space that will generate outsized returns. And we're saying we have the ability to find the best Black founders, the ones that have been overlooked by everyone, but that really have this opportunity to be the next Facebook, right? So it's exactly the same principle.
Now, within the VC fund world, you get mentors, you get advisors. Those advisories might sit on an advisory board. I can imagine that in your context, there's a more holistic view of the support you could provide to founders of Black-led companies. Tell us about that.
Again, I think it's pretty much the same, right? We're looking for mentors, for doers who have done the same thing, to provide them the typical support any venture capital firm would want to support. We want to basically provide that support to the portfolio companies. I think that's something that is probably unique with us is the deeper relationship that can be built as well with this understanding of, I guess, sometimes the invisible things that the rest of the society does not see that we have to face as a Black community. It's sometimes hard to communicate, and we don't necessarily have that issue. There's also a few other, I would not necessarily, you know, see it as, you know, part of the value addition piece that you're referring to, but a few other ways of connecting with our founders that is very specific to us. There's, you know, a few companies that are solving specific issues that have a large total addressable market, but that are sometimes less understood by mainstream VC. And the fact that they don't necessarily have to understand the root of the problem that they're trying to solve when they speak to us really creates that connection from the get-go, right? But generally, it's the same type of processes.
Have you noticed that the companies that you're investing in cluster around a sector or a geography or a psychographic, or is it really like everything all at once?
Everything all at once. We've seen everything. We've seen deep tech. We've seen fintech. There's a lot in the creative industry, in the sports and arts. We've seen biotech. It's been really interesting and really fascinating to see the diversity in terms of founders that we've been speaking with. And one of the pushback I think that we've received when we were fundraising for this fund was this belief that we probably would have a pipeline issue. And since we started less than 2 years ago, you know, we're focused on technology, on Black founders in Canada, and we've seen nearly 800 decks to date.
Wow.
Yes, so that there's a lot of people doing amazing things. You know, obviously not all the companies would be qualified, and we're extremely selective. We're investing, our target investment number is 18, right? So we'll have 18 portfolio companies by the end of our investment period. And right now we're pretty much halfway, about to close our 9th transaction. So it's been a good journey, to be honest. And we've been very, very impressed by the level of quality of the businesses we have, you know, spoken with.
Who is providing the capital that you're then able to deploy to invest in these companies?
It's 85% institutions. We have a few family offices, and we have also one foundation. So that's what makes us, I guess, special from that perspective. It was very surprising in 2021 when we were told that we were the first Black-led team in the VC space that has been receiving institutional dollars. And we are looking to help support the creation of, you know, many more diverse fund managers, because I think it's a richness for the ecosystem to have diverse perspective, diverse points of view. And we hope to be, you know, we're the first, but we hope not to be the last.
How do you go about choosing the companies that you invest in? I mean, we've seen Dragon's Den, so we know the TV version of this. I'm sure it is not like that in so many ways. How do you choose?
Well, we go through a due diligence process. First of all, for us, especially at the stage in which we invest mainly at the pre-seed and seed stage. Seed being, you know, really our sweet spot. It's about understanding who we are backing. The entrepreneur is the number one factor in this. There was a lot of, I think, attractiveness of the entrepreneurial space at some point, especially in 2021, where a lot of people wanted to do what they dreamt of without necessarily understanding what it takes to be an entrepreneur. It's one of the hardest jobs in the world. So really partnering with people who have the understanding of what it is and have the grit and, you know, have showcased that they are resilient. People who understand who they're selling to, understand the problem at its core. We go through a due diligence process where we speak with everyone. We speak with the advisors, the team, some customers. We look at data that the company has to provide to create our investment memo. And that's what we use to basically assess our participation in the round. And then we position ourselves as partners for growth, really trying to see how we can add the most value to the portfolio company that we chose.
So fascinating. Just before we go here, I want to hear about your fellowship program. You have a fellowship program.
Yes. And that's part of our purpose, right? So the way we're thinking about it is that if we're trying to create change to our activities in a sustainable way, it's about first, you know, sharing our pipeline with other VC funds. A lot of VC funds say we don't see the Black entrepreneurs. We obviously see a lot of them. So we share our pipeline and create co-investment opportunities to create opportunities for others to have a more diversified portfolio. But this would not necessarily be sustainable if there's not more diversity on the other side of the table. And that's also something we hear a lot about, that, you know, it's hard to find, you know, good people from the Black community to hire in the venture capital space. So we decided to create a fellowship program where we train Black professionals, you know, on VC, basically. And then eventually we hope that this will create, you know, a greater pipeline also on the employment side in the VC space. We started that in August. It's a nine-month education program. We're doing it in partnership with Future Capital in BC, in British Columbia, and with private education in Minnesota in the US. And we have been fortunate to be sponsored in this journey by BDC, RBC, and Fengate. Mm. So it's a good program. We're making sure that they have exposure to lived experience of a lot of VC funds, because in venture capital, you only learn by doing. Mm. and the more you're surrounded by the good people who have done a lot of deals, the faster your learning is.
Fantastic. Liz, I'm so excited by what you're doing, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to tell us about it today.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Thanks for your interest in what we're doing, and thanks for your support.
You're welcome. Liz Birkandavi is the co-founder of BKR Capital, a venture capital fund that invests in Black-led companies. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Our email address, ask@moolala.ca. You can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, any feedback on the show to ask@moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to our newsletter. You can find the moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast version of this show on any of the podcast platforms out there. On social media, I'm @BruceSellery on Twitter, Bruce Sellery La on Facebook. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.